As we begin this 61st episode of the History of the Christian Church, I need to do a little bit of housekeeping. The greatest challenge that I've had in doing this series, first as an audio podcast that began in 2012, is knowing how to organize and present the material. I think that's going to be true for anyone who attempts a review of the history of a major subject. You know, if all we're focusing on were a particular person or movement, we'd be able to track it in a neat timeline. But if we're covering a subject as broad as the history of Christianity, we're going to find ourselves having to go back to things that have happened earlier than the narrative we've taken in another subject. So the very first version of this church history series went to about 100 episodes when I realized that it was way too jumbled in its narrative of events. So I went back and redid them, trying to make the timeline neater. But even then, it required some backtracking to take on issues important to church history, but didn't fit into the narrative flow of the material. And I say all of that because after this episode, we're going to do a major hop back in time to take a look at what are called the historic creeds of the church. And here's why. This episode looks at Dun Scotus, another of the main scholastics, and it's going to wrap up that era of Christian theological perspective known as scholasticism. Then we have some episodes that set the stage for the Reformation. It comes as a surprise to many that the Reformation wasn't something that just came out of nowhere. The call for reform in the Western Church had been voiced for a long time prior to Martin Luther and Ulrich Zwingli. The Roman Church became the institution it was largely because of the creeds its councils produced, going all the way back to that first one in 325 at Nicaea. So, after this episode, we'll do a short series on the creeds, and then get back to setting the stage for the Reformation in Europe. Now, to our final episode on the scholastics. The Franciscans had an answer to the Dominican scholastic Thomas Aquinas that we looked at in the previous episode. This Franciscan counterpart lived at the same time. His name was John Bonaventure. Born in Tuscany in 1221 as John Fidanza, he became known as Bonaventura when he had a miraculous recovery from a grave injury as a child of only 4. Upon regaining his health, his mother announced, "Bonaventura, good fortune," and the name stuck. While Aquinas was predominantly a theologian, Bonaventura was both a theologian and an accomplished administrator in the affairs of the Franciscans. Now, where Thomas was precise but dry, John was a mystic given to great eloquence. While Aquinas was prosaic, Bonaventure was poetic. Now, Bonaventura joined the Franciscans and immediately excelled in his studies. He spent 3 years in Paris studying under the scholastic scholar Alexander of Hales. Alexander paid his pupil a huge compliment when he said that in Bonaventura, quote, "Adam seems not to have sinned," unquote. Finishing his studies in Paris, he stayed to teach, filling the spot of John of Parma when he took the leadership of the Franciscans. He was only 26 years old. Now, anyone would have been in over their head at that age, since Bonaventura became the leader of the Franciscans when they were, well, being split by the fracture that we talked about in an earlier episode when we were looking at them. He took a middle position between the two parties and was able to negotiate an uneasy peace. It was a brutally hard assignment, but Bonaventura pulled it off with aplomb and earned the title of the second founder of the Order of the Franciscans. The entire idea of begging for support, called mendicancy, came under assault during his term at the helm of the Franciscans. He penned a tract that silenced the opposition and reinforced support for the mendicants. At the direction of the First Franciscan General Council at Narbonne in 1260, he wrote The Legend of Francis, the authoritative Franciscan account of the order's founder. In 1273, he was made Cardinal of Albano, Italy, and died in Lyon while attending a church council the next year. The Pope performed extreme unction for him, and his funeral was attended by dignitaries from all over the Christian world. He was declared a Doctor of the Church in 1587, which is one of the highest honors the Roman Church can bestow. Dante, a fierce critic of sham religion, gave Bonaventura great honor by placing him alongside Thomas Aquinas as one of only a few uncorrupt church officials. These two, Aquinas and Bonaventura, will always be considered by students of church history side by side. One historian of medieval theology calls them the illuminating stars on the horizon of the 13th century. Aquinas had the sharper mind, but Bonaventura the warmer heart. Maybe this is why each joined their respective orders. Thomas was a Dominican, John a Franciscan. Now, Bonaventura enjoyed great popularity as a preacher. Being a poet, his sermons were far more eloquent than his peers. When Bonaventura wrote, like Aquinas, he turned his mind to theology and provided much to the cleaning up of the thoughts of the day. To give an idea of what kinds of things the scholastics wrestled with, here are some of the topics Bonaventura weighed in on. The Trinity, creation, sin, the incarnation, grace, the Holy Spirit, sacraments, and the afterlife. So having dealt with these basic topics, he engaged a whole host of other subjects that were more popular to discuss at the time. Things like, could God have made a better world? Could he have made it sooner than he did? Can an angel be in several places at the same time? Can several angels be at the same time in the same place? At the moment of his creation, was Lucifer corrupt? Did he belong to the order of angels? Is there a hierarchy among the fallen angels? Do demons have foreknowledge of contingent events? Bonaventura discussed whether or not sexual intercourse took place before the fall. Whether or not before the fall, men and women were equal. Did Adam or Eve sin more grievously by eating the forbidden fruit? With such weighty and important stuff, no wonder these guys spent a good part of their time sitting at a desk studying. Bonaventura agreed with Aquinas in denying that Mary was immaculately conceived and free of original sin. He disagreed with his fellow Franciscan, Duns Scotus, who we'll turn to in a moment, on the issue of transubstantiation. Though Scotus differed from Aquinas on precisely what the bread and the wine became, he did accept the idea that they became something more than mere bread and wine, while Bonaventura held to the symbolic nature for the communion elements. While Bonaventura was a brilliant mind, it's not his theology that he's known for. It's hard to be when you live at the same time as Thomas Aquinas. He's best known as the mystic and the author of The Life of St. Francis. While Aquinas's Summa Theologica became the theological textbook of the Roman Church, it was Bonaventura's devotional writings that stirred the hearts of thousands of everyday priests to seek God by grace and through his word. And that brings us to another Franciscan and the last of the scholastics that we're going to consider, John Duns Scotus. Now, let me begin by saying that the followers of Duns Scotus, called Scotus, and the Thomists, who followed Aquinas, formed the two great theological schools of the Middle Ages. The battle between them was fierce. At times, it became violent. I have to say that in reviewing Scotus's work, I have a hard time grasping his thought. Being of only average intelligence myself, most of his work goes right over my head. Scotus was a serious brainiac, and when I read him, I confess most times I'm lost. Now, I'm going to attempt a summary of his work later, but first, let's take a look at his life. We can cover it quickly because really there's not much known about him. He was born John Dunn in Scotland, thus the Latin nickname Scotus, by which he's best known. Scotus became a priest and joined the Franciscans. Most of his career was spent lecturing at Oxford. He eventually taught at Paris and Cologne, where he died in 1308. A monument to Scotus in the Franciscan Church of Cologne bears this inscription: Scotia gave me birth, England nursed me, Gaul educated me, Cologne holds my ashes. Now, among the stories told of Duns Scotus is one that gives more insight into his thoughts than entire chapters of his complex written discourses. Scotus engaged an English farmer on the subject of religion, and the conversation came around to predestination. The farmer, who was sowing his field, said to Scotus, "Why do you speak to me of it? If God has foreknowledge that I will be saved whether I do good or ill." Scotus replied, "Well, if God has foreknowledge that the grain in your bag will grow out of this soil, it will grow whether you sow or withhold your hand. You may as well save yourself the labor you're at." Scotus's point was clear. Without the farmer sowing the seed, it wouldn't gain the soil, and if it didn't gain the soil, it wouldn't sprout. which meant God would have known the farmer never sowed it. If it did sprout, it was because God knew the farmer would sow it. Even so, the farmer could not be saved without the change that the gospel brings. The gospel would not be heard unless SCOTUS shared it. So if God knew the farmer was going to be saved, it was because he knew SCOTUS was going to speak up, affecting a change by the gospel in the farmer. SCOTUS's mind was more critical than constructive. He tended to pick apart the thoughts and conclusions of others than to develop or declare his own positions. His work feels reactionary, though he was just using the dialectic method that was in fashion among the scholastics of that time. You'll remember that the great endeavor of the scholastics was to link faith and reason, to show that faith wasn't irrational, but that it was super-rational. They aimed to show that the intellect was a tool to inform and strengthen faith, not to weaken it, something completely lost to later theologians of the liberal bend. SCOTUS is regarded as last of the scholastics because his work, it really undercut their endeavor. You see, by using the questioning methodology of the dialectic, he attacked not the sufficiency of faith as some scholastics had, no, he attacked the sufficiency of reason as the means to arrive at knowledge. He subjected scholastic propositions to intense scrutiny. He showed how several of the theological positions of the church were difficult to support by reason, and yet the church said they were true. So the problem had to be with reason, not with church dogma. Some things had to be accepted, he said, by faith. SCOTUS's adeptness at asking questions that back people into logical corners earned him both supporters and enemies, as you can imagine. At times, his thoughts were so elaborate, his writings so confusing. Today, we refer to a muddle-headed person as a dunce, a word derived from his name. SCOTUS spent much of his time on the subject of the will. It was his work on it that framed the philosophical base for the reformers and their views on God's sovereignty and election. SCOTUS was the first major Catholic theologian to support the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception of the Virgin Mary. That, of course, holds that the mother of Jesus, though herself born of human parents, was conceived in holiness without the taint of original sin. That idea had been set forward a century earlier in France, where it immediately met controversy. SCOTUS defended the view at a public debate in Paris, employing 200 lines of argument for its support, and winning the university to his side. Although Aquinas rejected it, SCOTUS's view won the day. In December of 1854, so a lot later, Pope Pius IX, a Franciscan, understandably, declared the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception to be the divinely revealed fact, an official Catholic dogma. While Augustine remarked on Mary's exceptional holiness in the 4th century, the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception of Mary, it wasn't even a thing until the 12th century. It was then heavily debated until a century later when Duns Scotus, using scholastic methodology, made a convincing case for it, at least among some. While it remains a tenet of the Roman Church, the Reformers rejected it because it finds no support in Scripture. Now, of course, Aquinas' reputation in philosophy and theology has eclipsed Scotus's, though Scotus influenced a wide range of later thinkers, including the 18th century German Protestant philosopher Leibniz and the 20th century French Catholic theologian Teilhard de Chardin. The existentialism of the 20th century resurrected SCOTUS's emphasis on will over reason. Now, if you take a secular college philosophy class today, you will most likely be told that faith and reason are utterly separate. Reason, it's postulated, is based on evidence and the faculty of the mind. Faith is divorced from both reason and evidence. And reason, of course, always trumps faith. Now, this is a complete reversal from the scholastics, who may be attributed with some of the, well, loftiest moments in the long history of philosophical analysis. For them, faith came first, with reason a tool to help fill out and bolster faith. Duns Scotus began the drift away from that by showing how untrustworthy reason could be. His goal was to remind scholastics that in their emphasis on reason, they'd neglected the primacy of faith. But in the divorce that he postulated between faith and reason, what happened was that later thinkers ran with reason as separate from and superior to faith. If Duns Scotus showed up at a college philosophy lecture today, he'd weep that his ideas had been so poorly developed, and he'd annihilate the shoddy thinking of the purely secular philosopher.